When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name is Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Buonasera, Windy.
And our tactics guy and Charlie Kane's latest acquisition, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Yes!
Is he going to try and force through your transfer to the Oh What a Night podcast by making you go on strike?
Yep, he's measured me up for a three-piece suit already.
Unbelievable. Sat there on his office motorbike. Absolute oddball. On to that in a moment. Congratulations to Abby and Dakota on their wedding this weekend. Dakota of the podcast that we released midweek. Incredible story. Really appreciated Dakota telling it. Lovely, lovely person. Everyone should listen. It's pretty special. Last week, I annoyed people by mentioning Lewis Holtby in relation to Eric Lamella's cult hero status.
Oh, yeah.
I apologise. I absolutely was not comparing them in terms of like how beloved they were by the fan base. That was nothing that I meant at all. It was just that they were both like hype merchants off the pitch. That was it. That was it. That was what I was getting at. Lamella, after an eight-year stint at Spurs, is obviously much more beloved than Lewis Holtby, for fuck's sake. I can't believe I'm having to clarify this, but yeah, I upset people.
I remember when we signed Holtby, there was a lot of hope and optimism around this young man.
He was.
I mean, Germany capped him to keep him away from England.
No, it was awful. He was really bad in the end, but he seemed genuinely really pleasant, and everyone warmed to him, and he became like the guy in Spurs' social media work, and that's kind of what I was getting at, like the way that he wasn't loved for what he did on the pitch, but he became a cult hero for what he did off the pitch. And I mean, the Mellor is loved for what he did on the pitch, but not in the way that it was intended. Anyway, we also upset people, or I think I upset people with by saying Brian Gill. So that we recorded last week's episode prior to him putting a video of himself pronouncing
during
his own name.
The video was posted, and I was really tempted to like get my phone speaker out to my microphone and play it onto the podcast, but I thought it would be a mess. So I let you suffer for it. I just thought you'd watch you struggle through instead.
So the thing is, I try really hard to get the pronunciations of players right, because I think it's the respectful thing to do. And when I was doing my research on Brian Gil, as he calls himself, I was watching lots of Spanish games with Spanish commentary, and the Spanish commentators were often calling him Brian Gil.
Interesting.
But that was just the way they said his name. So that's why I went with Brian Gil. I just thought, okay, maybe there's not a different pronunciation on the G in this particular name. But yeah, he absolutely says his name as Gil.
We'll just keep that. As long as we're doing the Italian names all right, we'll be all right. The Spanish can suffer.
Yeah.
But the good news for you, buddy, is that you have a heel to die on now.
Hey!
Very good.
How long have you had that lined up for?
like pretty much since I learned how to say his name.
Fuck's sake.
It's not even good, is it?
No, it is good. Credit where it's due. That is good.
That's a podcast title.
That is the title of absolutely. Maybe not today's, but it's in the bank.
when it does something special, we'll call it. We'll use it.
Yeah. So I guess we need to touch on or start off with the extreme lengths which Harry Kane is going to avoid the bleep test, which are going on strike. So here's where I am. I thought Harry Kane was like not wanting to say or do too much to ruffle feathers because it's Harry Kane and he's whiter than the white and he does everything in the most sort of clean shirt way.
Yeah.
And if he didn't get his move, like, he'll be annoyed, but it's Harry Kane, so he'll just knuckle down and get on with it and we'll get the best from him because he's an absolute top pro and why would we ever expect anything different? And behind the scenes, he might be a bit disgruntled for a season, then he'll go next year and, you know, it won't be the end of the world. Oh, no. So, obviously, the advice he's been getting from people around him is you now need to force through this move. You need to take some actions to force through this move, and those actions are go and speak to Gary Neville before the season's out. If that doesn't work, you leak stories to the press about a gentleman's agreement. If that doesn't work, you don't turn up for your first day of training when you're due at the Spurs training ground, because you know that's going to create an absolute media storm, and it has. You know, it's one of the most famous footballers in the country. It's the national team's captain. He hasn't shown up for training on his first day back. This is absolutely insane. I personally think this does more harm. I really think this does more harm to Kane than anything else. Like, I just think this is an awful look for him. It ends a lot of the goodwill that I think Spurs fans have had over this whole scenario. Like, where a lot of fans have kind of gone, look, one of the best players in the country, he deserves to be winning titles. If he wants to move and we get a fair fee, then fine, he goes with our blessing. I don't think that's the case anymore. I don't think he gets to go with our blessing after this. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I've misjudged the reaction that fans will have. But certainly, you know, my view, I was annoyed after the Gary Neville interview, if I'm honest. I've not felt the same about him since then. But this is next level. This is so disrespectful to his fellow teammates and to his new manager. Jesus Christ, what must poor Nuno be thinking he's walked into here? And he's going to have to deal with these questions at every press conference he does until the transfer does or doesn't happen. Oh my goodness. Bardi, where are you?
I've had this growing feeling inside about Harry Kane and my detachment from what a guy that was once one of our own to an individual who has become just Harry Kane, stat muncher, stat padder, guy that wants to break records just so he can put it next to Harry Kane's name. And I think this whole move to Manchester City kind of started to cement it, because he wants to go to City to win trophies because he wants his name associated with trophies. And now this move today just makes it clear that Harry Kane is so far away from being one of our own, from being the symbol of a Spurs fan into a football player, that I don't care about Harry Kane anymore. I would miss Harry Kane's goals and I'd miss his output, but for what he brings as a kind of standard bearer of Tottenham, it's not for me anymore. I said in the piece that I put behind a firewall, firewall, because I was concerned that these feelings might be completely the polar opposite from what everyone else is feeling, but I found some kindred spirits out there, and I'm just tired of this. It's the Harry Kane team, but it's like our team Tottenham now exists to serve our star striker and to help him achieve what he wants to achieve, and it's not what Tottenham wants to achieve. And I'm done. I'm tired. Move him on. Get the money and let's buy somebody else.
I think in a sentence what you've just said, Bardi, is no single player is bigger than the club, right?
No, it never has been. We look at the players that we've had and we've lost. And I remember being a child and when we lost Waddle, that was heartbreaking. I remember when we lost Sol Campbell, who was, you know, he was one of the best English defenders, one of the best defenders in Europe at the time. And we lost him to Arsenal on a free transfer. And we've gone through heartache. And if this is the end for Kane, then fine, that's it. He leaves scoring a shitload of goals and being up there as amongst our best ever players. But him now not turning up for training, that's childlike. And I don't know who's advising him. It's just not a good look, and just let's just move on.
Yeah, I don't think it's a good look at all. And I also think the Kane brothers think they're playing this game of 4D chess, but actually what they're playing is a game of Snap, because this is just, it's so basic, it's unreal. Nathan, what are your thoughts and how do you think this ends?
Well, it's hard for it to end well now. You've made the point before that like he wants it both ways. Yeah, he wants to like be the club legend and also get his move.
Yeah.
And this is fucked that. This is like so far like, and as you've already said, like so far he's played it by the book. He's like, look, you know, I do have to assess my options. I do want to win trophies. I hope that the club could listen if there are bids coming in. But obviously I'm concentrating on my time at Tottenham and all those kind of like, he's very like super hitting the media lines again and again and again. And that's basically what he's done so far. That interview with Gary Neville, there was a lot more like said about it than said in it, you know? But it was kind of a bit of an open secret with that was sort of the message between the lines there. But this is just, this is going on strike. This is trying to force things through without ever having handed in a transfer request. This is the big public move. And, frankly, I can't believe it, but I did expect better of him. I did, you know, with all of the horrors of being a modern football fan, I did think, well, at least Harry Kane will be like honest and true and fair. And the gentleman's agreement fiasco, as we saw before with Bale, as we saw with Modric, has happened again. Two players who stopped turning up for training because they believed they had a gentleman's agreement. Now, it's not like I've never heard this phrase before outside of Tottenham, but it's very much a recurring theme. Three players in a row saying, I had a gentleman's agreement with Daniel Levy, and three players refusing to turn up to training. That's a really worrying trend. I don't understand what these gentlemen agreements might be or how they might be made to feel about them or how persuasive they are. They obviously have no legal contractual actual meaning. I don't know if the phrase comes from Levy, if that's something that he likes to use and say, if he describes something as a gentleman's agreement and ends on a handshake. But players have got to stop falling for it because it's obviously nonsense. And within that, like, God, I always want to side with the worker. I always want to say, look, you know, do everything you can to get everything you can out of your boss, essentially. And I highly encourage all listeners to strike whenever it is appropriate to strike. But this isn't about watching a relationship between Kane and Levy from a distance. This is also a relationship between Kane and us. And I think he owes us more than that, to be honest. Not Daniel Levy. He doesn't owe the business of Tottenham Hotspur, PLC, anything. But he owes us as fans better than this, I think, to be honest.
Yeah, I feel quite disrespected by Harry Kane throughout this. And to be honest, like, Spurs fans have aggressively fought his corner over a number of years, possibly too aggressively, to be honest. We've backed him on everything. On everything it's possible to back him on, we've backed him. To the point where it's made us look a little bit silly in the eyes of other fan bases on numerous occasions, but we've done it because we love him. He's been loyal to us. He's always seemingly been honourable to us until now. And this doesn't feel good at all. It really does not feel good.
And the thing is that it's pointless. Like, it doesn't have an upside. Like, the situation 2 days ago and the situation in 2 days' time is if City bids an enormous amount, he'll go. And if he don't bid an enormous amount, he won't go. He's not budging that figure more than 5 million either way. He's doing himself so much harm for fuck all in return. So it's not only shit, but it's also stupid.
I mean, we don't even know if City's made an offer on him.
Right, exactly.
We know that Grealish is at training today after City have made £100 million bid, and just go about your work. But part of it is like, if we're not going to sell him, imagine the condition he's going to be in after 2 weeks of just smashing biscuits on holiday and then another 2 weeks of sitting around his house. At least he's got to go to City in bits.
That's for the best. He needs the ankle time off anyway. Biscuits and sitting is probably actually long term not that bad for him. There you go. Look, if there has been 160 million bids that both clubs have kept quiet from their respective journalists and we've turned it down, I guess it's a slightly different situation, but we're really speculating if that's the idea.
I'm interested. I'm not sure that Kane would have done this without some assurances from City, or we say City, we assume City, but then we've also heard this week that City are trying to buy Grealish and haven't got enough money to buy both of them. So you start going, okay, maybe it's not City, maybe there's another team in for him. Man U was mentioned somewhere. So my thoughts are, like, has Kane had assurances that there's an offer incoming that's going to be accepted, or that, sorry, there's an offer incoming that's going to be rejected, but if he goes on strike, it might force it through? Because otherwise, like Nathan said, this seems like a bizarre thing to do. It's bad PR for him, terrible PR for Harry Kane. And as Nathan correctly points out, this action is not going to change Daniel Levy's mind. He's the most stubborn man in football. We know this. Harry Kane knows this. I mean, if he's kind of frustrated about the gentleman's agreement not being upheld, he should know if Levy's not going to uphold that, he's not going to sell him on the cheap. That's the last thing he's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So what's he think he's going to get out of this? This is what I meant by the Kane brothers thinking they're playing 4D chess. It's really, really not the move they think it is. I feel like they're being played, to be honest, by whoever's speaking to them from the other club side. And I think this just looks bad. I don't know how City could spend, what is it going to be, 260 million in one window without selling a hell of a lot of players first. So like maybe he should have waited for them to sell some players before acting this way. Because if they don't make the offer that Levy wants, he's not going to sell him. So Kane comes back with his tail between his legs at the end of the transfer window. What's he going to do? He's going to have to make an apology to Spurs fans. We won't ever feel the same way about him. It's going to damage the relationship forever. I just don't see that he's thought this through. It seems a bizarre step to take to me.
I mean, it won't damage his reputation forever because Modric tried to snake us by going to Chelsea, but then he stayed and had one of his best seasons, and he was brilliant, and then he got his move to Real Madrid. We forget, winning games and scoring goals makes everybody forget everything. We can ignore the fact that Harry Kane swore on his daughter's life that he scored a goal. We can forget that he hasn't done half the kind of work that Henderson and Rashford has done. We can forget that he hasn't made a stand about anything other than scoring goals, because he scores goals, and we will let that slide. If this doesn't happen and he stays and he starts banging in the goals, we will forget all about this until Sky Sports or The Sun bring it up again. Because that is the problem with football. It's one of the greatest things about football, that you will forget everything. But it is also a huge problem. Had Mourinho won 38 games 1-0 and we'd won the league, we would have forgiven everything that Mourinho, what I would have done anyway. We would have forgiven him.
No comment.
The irritating thing about this is obviously the timing too. It's absolutely shocking timing. A couple of weeks away from the season start. It doesn't leave a lot of time to get anything done, to sign a replacement. We've seen increasing links with potential striker signings. I mean, at the time we were thinking like Kane rotations, but now maybe it will be a Kane replacement. So Dusan Vlahovic being the most obvious. But there was no, who was the other link this week that I currently can't remember off the top of my head? Martinez was linked as well. Yeah?
Who?
Lautaro Martinez.
Uh-huh. Oh, he loves to miss a goal. He's good, but he loves missing a sitter.
He's been linked this week as well, right? I'm not making that up.
Inter have been trying to flog him for quite a while, and Barcelona have been interested in him. But as we all know, Barcelona haven't got any money.
Mm.
So I think Inter would be willing to sell, but I don't know if he's worth it. He struggled his first season, and then he started to find some form playing off Lukaku. But yeah, I don't think he has the same kind of goal output as Harry Kane, but very few people do.
Fair. And Vlahovic is... He's impressive and popular amongst the Spurs fan. But I think that signing would go down well amongst everyone. But like that, it was. There's one thing, the signing going down well when you've got Harry Kane. But would he be a suitable replacement, Nathan?
Well, he's very different. He's not like he's not similar at all. He's an in behind striker. He's an in behind striker who's also tall and not terrible with his head as a result.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have like the hold up game or all of the rest of Harry Kane's game at all. But he does have the legs that Kane is missing, which is why they sort of like, that's why when we're linked with Vlahovic and Ings and the paper talk is that we're looking for a striker partner, it's pretty easy to believe. Having said that, like Nuno's style is he prefers his forwards to be an in-behind forward.
Yeah.
But, you know, you'd rather have one of the best players in the world who's a tactical misfit than a good good player who's also a good profile. It's just
that's fair.
You know, Son can do the running or whatever. So, man, it's hard to sort of, like, it's hard to feel positive about it. And I think that, it will take more than Vlahovic to, like, he's good. Like, he'd be a very good signing, but it takes more than, like, him to replace Harry Kane's output. There's got to be, like, continued investment throughout the whole team, obviously. I mean, we know that's the case. We know that that's the situation anyway. But, I'm trying to find the way to, like, phrase it to be like, hey, look, it's definitely a downgrade, despite the fact that he would be a good signing, you know? Because who would be a suitable replacement for Harry Kane?
Exactly. Yeah. That's the problem we've got, isn't it?
I mean, this happened to us kind of like with Bale. It happened to us with Carrick as well, going back, that we do end up trying to replace a certain player rather than swapping a tactical style to suit the players we have.
Mm.
I'd be up for Vlahovic. I think he's an interesting prospect. He's 21 years old. He has a great goal output. He's not Kane, but then no one else is Kane. Kane is Kane. I'd be up for that. If we could sign Vlahovic, Romero, and then perhaps one more, then I think it's not a bad thing, considering we're cashing in on a 28-year-old snake who's got ankles made of glass.
Vardy's going in.
It is fun calling him a snake, you know, because Danny Rose got called a snake, but Danny Rose is just being Danny Rose. This is the pin-up boy for England. This is England's captain. This is the darling of Coy's Twitter. This is the everybody's hero, and we could call him a snake. It's brilliant. It's like one of these celebrities that everyone thought was brilliant and untouchable, just getting found out for being a dirty perv. And yeah, maybe that's what we found.
He's John
out.
Leslie.
He's John Leslie.
Buddy, you can't spell snake without K-A-N-N-E, right?
That was what someone tweeted me. That was a very good tweet.
Great tweet. So aside from the Kane saga, let's call it a saga. There's another saga ongoing. Christian Romero's transfer, which, look, if I'm honest, I think were it not for social media, this wouldn't be seen as a saga. It would just be seen as a transfer that's progressing in a linear fashion from start to finish, which will ultimately end with him signing. But because of this sort of constant drip feed of any update from Fabrizio Romano, amongst others, it has felt like the most long-winded transfer of all time. It's how negotiations work, isn't it?
It's weird that, like, we've got to this level of information. We've got to this level of information. Like, it was not much more than 5 years ago that it's like you might hear a player's name in a paper and then a month later they might be signed. And now we get like every single meeting. Even if there's like no real change in the next meeting, they're like, well, there's been another meeting and they're still apart on terms and they're feeling less good about each other now. And then also that club are like considering this other player and that might have a role in it. That's the level of like, we're basically in the meeting at this point and it's bizarre. You're right.
Somebody, so last week it was 27 years since we signed Jurgen Klinsmann, and I was having a chat with Spooky on Twitter about this, and somebody asked me that they weren't born when Jurgen joined, and what was the reaction to the transfer like, and it did remind me that, just ignoring the fact that he was a brilliant player, but it was a transfer that kind of happened out of nowhere. We didn't know anything about it. There was no ITK, there was no hashtag here we go. It was here, oh my God, Jurgen Klinsmann is on a yacht talking to Alan Sugar, and then the next thing we knew he was signing. And I think you're completely right, the Romero thing looks like a saga because we're just privy to so much information and every single step of the transfer is being publicized. I do kind of wish for those days when Jurgen Klinsmann would just arrive and we wouldn't have to go through this, because the same happened with Ndombele. There was last minute twists and turns. Bergvine, Schoenberg was going to Everton and everyone was panicking, just pay the money. It's just people have to write about something, and I think that's what we're seeing now with Romero.
I thought you were saying that like those were players that just announced out of the blue. So Bergvine, I think, pretty much came without any previous reporting, if I remember correctly. It literally just landed, didn't it? And it was like, wow, okay, great. That's how I like transfers to happen.
No one knew who Bergvine was apart from his parents.
Bless. That seems a bit harsh. He's playing really well in the preseason, by the way. I've been super impressed. Let's talk about the outs. A couple of outs this week, actually. So Troy Parrott has joined MK Dons on loan for the season, and nice. Keon Etete has joined Northampton Town on loan for the season. There were some, I don't know if it was reporting or ITK, but we'd been linked with Northampton Town's dribbly young forward Caleb Chukwuemeka, who I understand is a really good prospect. I haven't seen him play. I don't really know a great deal about him. I know he's got good numbers dribbling-wise, and he's 19. And there was some talk that we might send a player to Northampton in part exchange. So I'm wondering if the Atete transfer could be a make-weight for Chukwuemeka joining Spurs. We'll see, I guess. The Parrott deal, I think, is a good move for him, or it was a good move, until their manager, Russell Martin, got strongly linked almost immediately with a transfer away, which is exactly what happened to Parrott last season. It would be very unfortunate. MK Dons played some good stuff against us. I thought they played some nice progressive football and he would fit in really well to that structure. It would be a good learning environment for him. But if Martin leaves, then...
then maybe not.
Yeah, it just feels like a shame, unless they can appoint a similarly progressive coach who can use Parrott in a similar system. I guess we wait and see on that one. Meanwhile, Joe Hart is still being linked to the move to Celtic. And oh my goodness, boys, we might get £1 million for him. Can you believe it? We might get £1 million for Joe Hart.
Mate, if they cover the taxi, then it's a good deal. Like,
exactly. Absolutely.
Pretty good deal. £1 million for someone who just did some cricket stuff in the changing room is pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. And Cameron Carter-Vickers is also being linked with a £5 million move to Celtic.
Wow, that's some mad skills to get both off our books to the same team. Brilliant.
Yeah, and Carter Vickers is, I think, a year left in his contract, maybe, something like that. So even better.
Yeah.
And still, this story about Davinson Sanchez joining Sevilla rumbles on. Originally, it was a link with a Jules Koundé swap deal.
Mm.
That seems to have gone quiet. Chelsea, we know, are looking at trying to sign Koundé. Potentially, they wanted to swap him for... who was it they were talking about?
Zuma,
Kurt Zuma, wasn't it? Yeah. Mm. But Zuma apparently doesn't want to go to Sevilla, so I guess Chelsea are trying to restructure that transfer. In the meantime, Sevilla definitely want Sanchez still, so that would be a good move for us if we can offload him there. I am slightly concerned now that the days are starting to drift away, and it's not long to go until the start of the season, and we don't really have much of a squad in place. So there's that. How are we feeling about the pre-season matches? We played MK Dons Wednesday just gone. Another good performance. Lucas looked, I thought, very bright. Buddy, did you watch that game?
I've seen the highlights, and you're right, Lucas looked pretty good. That's a couple of games in a row now where he's done some nice passing.
Yeah.
He's done his Lucas-style dribbling, but there's been some output at the end of it. Mm. The last season, for all the mess there was, he did have his moments where he looked like a good player. I still don't think Lucas is the answer to any question that we have, but I'm not really against him being a squad player. I'm okay with that. I don't think anyone's going to buy him, so keep him around the club.
He loves preseason, Lucas.
Yeah.
Like,
he
always seems to play well. He was... I remember bubbly last preseason as well.
Only Lamella likes preseason more than Lucas.
Yeah. Nathan, have you picked up anything else in this MK Dons performance?
No, it's just good Nuno style football working with players who are like sharper than the counterparts. I do want to talk about Lucas. I want to talk about like kinesthetic advantage, right? You know, you're playing like down the park or you're doing like five-a-side or whatever, and there's one guy who's like just much better than everyone else, right? And there's an obvious like Messi comparison because like they are like...
They're running rings around players.
But they're doing it like there are bags of skills and there's practice there and there's expertise there, but there's also like deeper than that. Just a more innate, not just athletic, but like, well, kinesthetic. I mean, like they're perceiving time slower than you are, right? They're able to think through their actions and put practice into those actions and make three touches while you're still trying to defend the first, right?
I know that feeling from playing seven aside.
Yeah. And those are the players that like go on to make it into academies, right? And then the ones who have the advantage over those are the ones who maybe make it into professional football, and the unusual ones of the unusual ones are those who make it into like Champions League level clubs. And then Messi is the most unusual man, right? The unusual man amongst unusual men amongst unusual men amongst, and he is able to make the best defenders in the world look a whole step, a whole thought behind him, as he sort of just has a little micro touch, a little micro shift of the ball with one touch and sits Boateng on his ass by turning it the other way. It's the simplest trick, right? And it's one that we've all put on someone else, and it's one we've all had put on us, is you shift the ball one side, they step across, you shift the ball back, they stumble over themselves and you're through on goal. But it's Messi's ability to do that at such a speed, at such a speed of action, such a speed of the ball moving, such a subtleness, such a precision, such a feint on it, which is why he's the best player ever. But this isn't about Messi, this is about Lucas. And I just feel that like Lucas was that player growing up, right? That Lucas was that player in Brazil. For sure. Lucas was that player in the academy. And as a result, that's how he plays. But whereas Messi, who's the extreme example here, maintains that advantage over the best players in the world, Lucas falls in the tier below that. And he's still trying to play that way. And we see this in the Premier League. We see this in the Champions League with him. Not that he doesn't have moments, obviously. He scored that Champions League hat-trick. He scored brilliant goals. He's done brilliant dribbles. But he's constantly essentially trying to be Messi and just dribble through the middle of everywhere. And he doesn't have quite that significant enough advantage over the defender that he plays against, so that he might beat one and he might beat two, but the third one he runs into. And that's the difference between Lucas and Messi. Okay, Messi has a great passing range and everything else as well, but the main feature is Lucas is just that tiny bit slower of action, slower of thought. But in pre-season, that's not true, because the players he's playing against, specifically in this case, are League One, League Two and Championship, but also are not at full fitness. So Lucas looks like the best player in the world at the moment, but he's not. We must not allow these performances against half-fit League One players to make us think that Lucas is the player that he plays like, because, or tries to play like, because he isn't. I think that's all I have to say about Lucas for now.
I think that's fair enough. He just lacks the awareness as well. He doesn't know when to stop. He beats one man, and you're right, he just keeps on going because he thinks that's the correct thing to do. He just needs to stop and get his head up. He does have an almighty spring on him for a little guy, and he remains incredible. pretty useful at set pieces. I'm not against him staying. Yeah.
There's a moment for Deli's goal where he knocks the ball round a player and runs round the other side of him. The place he knocks that ball into is the space between the opposition's midfield and defence, and that the second, or maybe only a half second, it takes for him to run all the way round a player and catch up to that ball, it just doesn't exist at higher levels and in professional matches. And he's going to try that move again because he can do it when he has that significant enough advantage over his opposition, you know. And it's great, you know, it's brilliant to watch him in pre-season because he looks incredible, but the advantage he needs to make that work for him just doesn't exist in the vast majority of games that he will play in the season.
I think that's a really well-made point. And so sometimes you'll watch cup matches and a player will stand out, and it's often Lucas, to be fair, against lower league opposition.
Yeah.
And you'll see comments on social media and whatnot, people saying, oh, so-and-so's found their level. I remember Winks gets a lot of this. Winks has found his level. The idea being that, yeah, he looks good when he plays up against League One, League Two teams, but he doesn't look good for the first team. And I think it's a comment that's used too often and unfairly. But it does, like Nathan just described, it genuinely does apply on occasion. I think, like, for all the reasons you've just mentioned, it's absolutely correct to say that a player who struggles when they are restricted in terms of space, suddenly finds a space and they look good. That's a legitimate thing to say. And yeah, absolutely, Lucas is someone who, when he's given space, he knows how to use it. He makes the most of it. He takes the piss out of players that can't keep up with him and can't keep up with his quick feet, and looks incredible. And if he went to another league, which was a little bit weaker, I genuinely think he would tear it up, and he would probably love it. He'd have a great time in China. He'd be a hero. But for all those reasons, he does need to not be in our first team too much next year, because he will just flatter to deceive once again. He will probably score 5 goals, maybe assist another 5 more, and that's not enough. We need more productivity.
Lucas reminds me of back in the day when I used to go on nights out. Like if the dance floor was kind of packed and tight, I looked like an okay dancer. I could kind of get away with it. But when I had space and time to bust a move, you could see that was useless. So it was just legs and arms. And the fact that I just tried really hard and had a lot of stamina didn't mean anything. I had no timing or no skill. And that's, I guess, found out quite a lot as my wife can dance. That, yeah, if it's nice and tight, I look all right. If it's open spaces, forget it.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We then had open training on Saturday, which I caught a little bit of. I thought it was fairly entertaining, not particularly interesting, if I'm honest. Didn't really learn a great deal. And one of the things I picked up on was, so there's been a lot of emphasis on individual duels. Like, a lot of the drills involve players competing against one another, which I think is quite a new thing. And again, resistance. So in this occasion, they were using resistance bands around players when they were doing some of their drills, which I found that quite telling. I think that there was some reporting just after Nuno joined that he felt that when he played Spurs as Wolves boss, that they were quite easy to wrestle off the ball. And obviously he's trying to build core strength amongst our players, which I think is a sensible starting point. And then there was like lots of small-sided games, which looked really fun, but you know, you didn't learn a great deal other than Eric Dier couldn't keep up with Tongi and Ndombele and scythed him down, which Ndombele wasn't very happy about. Nathan, we also got a first glimpse of Pierluigi Gollini.
Great.
Did you watch his drill?
He maybe he let in some long distance shot. Like, well, I'm not gonna make a call on him as a player based on the open training. A lot of the resistance stuff was like muscular development, muscular warm up for like the supportive hip muscles, which is something that I'm having to do a lot of at the moment as well, because I'm suffering with injuries that have plagued me for quite a while. So I've noted down some of the techniques that they use with the sideways band and stuff like that, and the high step for glute medial warm up. But yeah, developing like the supportive strength for the amount of yards that Nuno wants them to cover through pre-season. And then there was one training drill that was, so they're split into three teams, and one of the teams is sort of placed around the outside of a coned area, and then two of the teams are inside the middle, and the inside team who have possession can use the outside team, so then they now have an outnumbering, and their role as a collective, as a two-team collective, is to get the ball across what is a pseudo for the width of the pitch, right, is to switch the play. And the third team is to close them down, try to win the ball. So you're simultaneously training collective pressing from the team without the ball. You're collecting, retaining possession under pressure, mm-hmm. and you're pushing the focus towards working it towards the wings and using the spare man in a wide area as a safe place to reset the play and work the ball like that. So that's a sort of the all-encompassing Nuno drill. Is everything you want from his football is pretty much there. And he stopped the drill midway through because the team in possession were keeping the ball in the middle too much, and he wanted taking too many passes to get from outside player to outside player, and he wanted the possession team to make that switch within two or three passes. So clear ethos there, but then the rest of it was all just shooting drills and then a bunch of sort of seven aside games. I think it was seven.
Mm. I think a lot of the training was, you know, SAQ stuff, speed, agility, quickness, just because it looks kind of interesting, getting them to run up and down the ladder and then using the resistance bands. You're not going to invite people into an open training session and then just do a Guardiola and just put people in squares and just talk to them. It has to be a little bit dramatic and it has to be some kind of entertainment.
While we've been speaking, Dan Kilpatrick has tweeted that Spurs are planning to give Harry Kane a significant fine for failing to report back to the club. What are your initial thoughts on that, Bardi?
Oh, one week's wages. That's what I would do. Drop down menu, 1 week fine, and he'll accept it if real life was Football Manager.
Nathan, is that the right approach?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
It has to be, doesn't it?
It's not acceptable, is it? So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I would love to know how the rest of the squad feel about this situation. I imagine that some of them will have some sympathy because they've probably been through similar situations before at previous clubs. But I also think there would be a core of players who feel quite disrespected by this whole situation, particularly from a sort of dressing room leadership figure. And I also think it'd be quite unsettling. It's not like conducive to a good environment. So there has to be a display of club discipline here. But it was a massive challenge for Nuno Espirito Santo in his first few weeks as Spurs manager to have this to deal with. God, I really feel for him. It's a crappy situation for him to come into. One player we forgot to mention in the links, Bardi, is Adama Traore, who had been linked. And some of the numbers mentioned were absolutely ludicrous. It struck me as a bit of a strange link because he wasn't getting that much game time for Nuno at Wolves. So, Bardi, what do you think of that one?
If we don't need him, we've already got Adama Light and Lucas. I think.
Yeah.
I think just the last thing we need. He's an interesting player. He's, you know, when he's not on your team, he's fun to watch. But I don't want him at Tottenham. Mm. £45 million can be spent much better elsewhere.
For sure. Yeah. I completely agree. I'm gonna delve into some older questions because we've been storing them up for a while. Nathan, this one's specifically for you. This is from Luke Wayne,
okay,
who says, "What is it like to work on football full time outside of football? How does Nathan structure his work, or is it pure freedom for him being outside of a club? And would he like his portfolio of work to take him into professional football in the future, or does he prefer the idea of having that sort of journalistic freedom?"
Let's break that down, I guess. So what is it like to work full-time outside of football and how do I structure my work? So I am currently seeking diagnosis for ADHD. We talked about this on the couch episodes that we did together, Windy. I'm pushing forward with that. I had a call with my doctor recently. He wanted to faff me about. I'm now looking to sort of use the threat of private care to force things through because I really want medical treatment for this. So I will... My girlfriend thinks that I work all day, every day, right? Because what happens is I will work for half an hour and then go do something else for an hour. And then I will work for half an hour because that is my attention span and that's what works for me. And I'll do that from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep. So to her, it seems like I'm just always busy, right? That works for me. That's why I need to do that. That's why I fail within every 9-to-5 job I've had because I don't have the attention span for it. It burns me out completely. It makes me miserable. This really works for me. I have done some professional side football work before, and it's kind of in the middle, right? It's less 9-to-5 because they want things on the weekends, and they want things on the evenings, and therefore they're more relaxed about, you know, showing your face other times of day. But I'm finding more and more ways that this works for me. I set my own schedule. I am my own editor most of the time. I do ask for feedback both from you two and from subscribers. But this really works for me. I have friends who work in football and they work ridiculous hours. They have ridiculous demands, and a lot of the time the work they do never gets practical use anyway, right? They get a list of requests from their boss. They put forward, you know, hours and hours of text reports, video reports, data analysis, and then that player, they go, oh no, I don't like him, he's got like his legs are too long or whatever, or half the time some sort of racial bias. And then the chairman watches a YouTube highlights video of someone else and they spend double the money on a player who's half as good. So I'm really happy doing what I'm doing. I'm really happy with my creative freedom. I'm trying to get more efficient so I can churn out more content without sort of overdoing the workload on myself. So how can I do things in a more effective way? But I'm really happy with what I'm doing. I love the freedom of what I'm doing. I love the creativity. I love to look and analyze football, but working in the industry itself is not all that appealing at all.
I would have to agree. Yeah. I've had opportunities to do some work inside football previously and just, no, would not want to do that. I like the distance from it, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is why our Patreon was the right thing at the right time, because it gives Nathan, I mean, we pay Nathan to make this content. It's perfect for him. We're all learning from the content Nathan's making, and the ex-subs, they seem pretty happy with it. So it's win-win in all counts.
Brian Hill video coming this week, I think.
Nice.
A couple of days.
Looking forward to that one. Bardi, I'll give you this one. This is from Petter, who said, a lot of what's been wrong with Spurs these past few years have been individual errors, mostly in defence. How much is this due to a non-functional collective? What is the chance of a more functional system making players such as Dier and Sanchez good again?
Yeah, I think this is a good point, because whenever Sanchez steps onto the field for Colombia and is partnered with Jerry Mina, who is a really physically imposing centre-back, he looks pretty good. And even though Colombia aren't great, he performs pretty well. And I've seen him on occasion pocket Lewandowski, Messi, his name's gone now, Cavani. So I do think there is a system issue there with Sanchez. I think he needs the right defensive partner to really shine. With Dier, I think you can make Dier work in a low block. As long as nothing's floating over his head, he'll be all right. So I do think it's a problem with a collective way of how we defend. Our centre-backs have been exposed for many years by a lack of a defensive midfielder and a lack of a system. So I do think there's something there. I still believe there's a good defender in Davinson, perhaps not as good as I thought he was going to be. But if you put the right partner next to him, he'll be an international standard defender. Eric Dier, no. But Davinson, yeah. So I don't see Spurs changing their system to make it work for Sanchez, which is why it's probably best he moves to Sevilla. And he'll probably do pretty well there and perhaps win a couple of trophies.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's unlikely that we offload both Dier and Sanchez this summer. Like, I could definitely see one of them going, probably Sanchez, but both of them seems optimistic. So I would imagine we'll find out the answer to that question this year, whether it's possible to make them look better in a more functional defensive system.
Mm-hmm.
This one is from 11 Tracks of Whack, who says, is there a worry that Spurs are too stocked with tweener players, i.e. players that can fit decently into two or three positions, but may not have the skill set to make them an elite player in an individual role? I know adaptable players are a plus, but I see us interested in Bruno to replace Eriksen at 10 and ending up with Lo Celso, and now prioritising a right back, but looking at Tomiyasu, who seems equally a right back and centre back. There are other examples too. Perhaps we end up with good players, but they never truly replace a specific need in our squad. Nathan, we've been very sort of supportive of signing players that can fill multiple roles in the squad previously, and we've liked the idea that players are versatile and can adjust to numerous systems. But do you think 11 Tracks of Whack is onto something here in terms of trying too hard to get adaptability and losing out on specialist players?
Short answer is no, essentially. I don't really have a general way of answering this. I'd have to go through every example one by one and say, like, we're interested in Tomiyasu specifically because we want to play a defensive right back, because we want to play like with a wonky formation with a high left back and a wide right winger and use that as a means of overloading the opposition. The fact that he can also play centre back is only an advantage when we may later move away from that formation and be more in need of a centre back, or we want to play a back three. So there's a thing about Bruno, Eriksen and Lo Celso, and I don't think that, like, I very much doubt positional versatility was an important factor in that decision. I think that just came down to price. So,
well, so the reporting previously, or some of the rumours have been that we could have had Bruno, but that Pochettino wasn't completely convinced.
Right. Probably a poor call by Pochettino. I mean, it was always, for me, the choice between the two was always very much up in the air. It's so easy now to say, how could you possibly say that? Look at the difference between the two. Bruno's one of the best players in the league. Lo Celso's been injured half the time. But I still feel, based on the information that was available at the time, looking at the track record from players of their type, players of the league, either one of them could have been outstanding, and either one of them could have been poor, because that's essentially the case with every single transfer. Bruno was completely, completely dominant in Premier League, but that doesn't always transfer. Whereas Lo Celso was outstanding in La Liga and pretty strong in Ligue 1, and still for me shows a hell of a lot of promise. So, Bruno's super specific, and the opposite of this, like, oh, well, you know, Eric Dier can play centre back, but only kinder, and Eric Dier can play defensive midfield, but only kinder, is like the opposite end is having a player like Bruno who does one thing, right? He receives the ball and he immediately goes for the killer ball, whether that is a shot from distance or whether that is a lofted through ball, right? He receives the ball in only a handful of spaces, and he will just every time immediately try something, has like 70%. Pass success, because that's his game, right? Receives the ball, does this one thing. And while that's worked tremendously well for United, at least most of the time, it's really not that difficult to imagine a scenario in which that isn't appropriate, right? If you imagine putting, well, there's like an example where, like, that's not too dissimilar to Cesc Fabregas. And Cesc Fabregas went to Barcelona during a period of time where they wanted slow and controlled tempo. They want to work the ball. And they brought Fabregas in because he's like a good Spanish lad, and they play on the national team with him, and they play him in like Iniesta's role when he receives the ball, and he immediately tries to ping a ball over the top, and no one's ready for that, and it doesn't fit. It's not because Fabregas isn't a different player, a bad player, and look, you've got me praising a former Arsenal player on the podcast again, you bastards. But it's just a tactical misfit, and it's definitely, I mean, the thing is that, like, if we'd have known that we were about to bring in Mourinho, Bruno and Mourinho could have been a good fit because of that, just immediate ball over the top. But then you also had Mourinho being very negative about his performance for Portugal and in his punditry role at the Euros. So maybe they would have had a complete clash of character, and we'd never have seen Bruno, and we'd have recorded podcasts all year saying, oh, why won't Mourinho play Bruno? It's so annoying. So we kind of got way off the question here, but like, versatility, maybe there are some question marks for like younger players about developing the right and developing specific skills when they're coming in for a few games to play left back, they're coming in for a few games to play midfield or whatever, and they're not getting consistent run of games because of their versatility. But the issue there is the lack of consistent run of games rather than the versatility itself. I only see it as a strength. I only see it as a bonus. All good players, like all of the best players in the world, the very best players in the world, can play multiple roles and multiple positions because they have the mastery over multiple abilities. Bruno is probably one of the most extreme, only does one thing, best players, right? So I don't think it's a bad thing.
See, I sit at the other end of the line on this, that I think a lot of it is down to us not having a manager or like a belief. Like, for example, if you hire Conte, Conte's going to sign a right wing back or a left wing back. And even if that left wing back is Ashley Young, who's not a very good player, he plays that role really well. And that's what he signed, a left wing back, or he wants a right wing back and he goes out to sign Hakimi. I think that not having a man, like Nathan mentioned, when we appointed Jose Mourinho, we didn't really give him the players he needed. He wanted a right back and we gave him a right wing back in Doherty. He wanted a centre back and we gave him Roden. I think a lot of it is the combination between the manager and the club doing what works best for them and really buying into that manager and just allowing him to build his team. At Spurs, we haven't done that. We just bought players on the chance because they're available. We signed Gareth Bale. Did we really need Gareth Bale? I don't think so. That money could have gone elsewhere. But it's a kind of machine gun approach to transfers that Tottenham have had for quite some time.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah, some great points. Let's end on this one from Philip Darbacy, who says, I have a tactical question. Can you explain some of the tactics that go into winning and losing second balls? I usually hear explanations like Team X wants it more or Team Y is on the back foot. Surely there's more to it than that with regard to shape and setup. And yeah, I mean, I completely agree. That is a completely fair critique of commentary on football, which I think whenever there's a sort of big sporting event that's not football, like the Olympics, like anything, like test match cricket, you're sort of reminded of how poorly fans are treated in football and like how the commentary is dumbed down so much, because the quality of punditry in other sports is just so much better, even from ex-sports people. Cricket is, I think, almost unparalleled in terms of the punditry. It's so well done. It's so well put together. And that's not just from the sort of the same old pros. You've got people like Ebony Rainford Brent, who's absolutely fantastic with her cricket punditry. But I think there's lots to say about this question. It sort of harks back to the points Nathan was making earlier about the open training session and the drills that Nuno was running around pressing. I mean, that will absolutely help with second balls, because the ball will be loose a lot of the time in those sessions, and Nuno will be making specific instructions on what he wants teams to do. Do you reset? Do you like get to the ball first and then reset? Or do you want to get to a ball quickly and punch a pass through? Or are you happy for the opposition to get the second ball? You get back into position and allow them to have it, but only in certain zones. There's all these different options. And typically, if a team is said to be good at winning second balls, it's because they've got lots of bodies around the ball in the first place. And that's the tactical consideration here. So a really sort of old-fashioned example would be Sam Allardyce's Bolton team. Absolutely exceptional at winning second balls, because they'd play a long ball up to Kevin Davis, who is their target man, very, very good at backing into defenders. So even if he didn't win the ball, he would make it awkward for the defender. The ball would often bounce off his head directly up into the air, and then Bolton would have three or four players very quickly around the area, which meant that they'd overpowered the opposition team. They'd outnumbered them, and they were able to win the second ball by sheer sort of presence of additional players and perseverance in that manner. And so naturally they won lots of the ball high up the pitch in good positions. Now, the downside of that is they didn't always do much with it, because the types of players they were using weren't necessarily the most technically gifted, although that changed as Allardyce went on. They signed players like Ivan Campo, who was really good technically, JJ Okocha. But I think it's an interesting point. Nathan, is there anything you would add?
It's kind of a matter of where you want your team to win second balls, which isn't to say everywhere isn't an option. I think if you look at, well, Pochettino's Tottenham at their best were a win the second ball everywhere type of team, because of the ability to suffocate the space behind them, or deny access to the space behind them, and therefore run rampage over sort of about a third of a football pitch. But that's essentially the amount of space you're working with, right? Because you only have so many players. And second balls comes from, it comes from fitness. It does come from desire. That has to play an element to an extent. But it's mainly going to come from like quantitative overloads, right? It's mainly going to come from having one player to force the centre back to header it, and a second player there where he's headering it to win it, right? That it's as simple as that. So Pochettino's Tottenham, really good at winning the second ball in front of the opposition's defence. Mourinho's Tottenham, really good at winning the second ball in front of their own defence, right? Mm-hmm. That's as simple as that. That's where they're doing those things. I think that if you look at sort of Klopp's sort of 17-19 Liverpool, probably best team in the world at winning second balls up and down the pitch. And part of that is midfielder archetype. Like they play three like highly physical box-to-box types and as a three-man midfield, which gives them some limitations, or certainly did at the time give them limitations in terms of like ball possession in a controlled manner and all the creativity and that kind of stuff, but gave them three engines to work with in winning second balls, because it was all about winning the second ball in midfield and hitting the counter there and then. Desire comes into it, because that has to play a role, but if you're an elite level footballer, you're working with a very high baseline of desire most of the time.
That's a really good point. And I think sometimes the sort of desire and he wants it more element is overstated, because generally it's a sort of, it's a prioritization of a burst of energy in that particular transition over another, whereas another team might, or another manager might choose for that same desire to be used in a different way. In exactly the way you've described there. So Pochettino wanted the desire to be when the ball was like in the opposition's defensive third, whereas Mourinho wanted the desire to be in your own defensive third. So it's just how you prioritise those bursts of energy and that use of extreme energy. Bardi, anything you would like to add to this?
No, I agree with everything you guys have said. The whole he wants it more is a bit, it's like quite a bit of nonsense. When England booted the ball up to Harry Kane and he didn't win the first ball, the second ball dropped to an Italian. That wasn't because England wanted the game less. It was because the England players were so separated from that guy. You can only win the second ball if you have human beings near the ball when it happens. So mm-hmm. I think a lot of it comes down to tactics and shape rather than this guy is not. I mean, of course, in a 50-50, perhaps you've got players that don't want to get injured because they want to represent their country or whatever. But I do think a lot of the time it is nonsense and something which pundits use just to bash modern footballers. I want to comment quickly on your take on cricket versus football. I do think cricket is a slower production, for example, and you can take your time in between overs, changing ends, in the same kind of way American football perhaps is a bit more tactical because it's just slower. Football is pretty fast. But it is changing football. We do this podcast, there's lots of tactical discussions out there now, so football is changing. But yeah, the kind of meat and potatoes of it, the Sky Sports, BT Sports, they do kind of get the ex-players on who just want to talk about passion rather than what's actually happening on the pitch.
Yeah, I'm hoping the introduction of some younger ex-pros will help. I really like your point about England and Italy there, Bardi, and I think that's also, it's triggered another thought in my brain, which is quite often there's another deeper tactical element to it, which is, well, the ball that Harry Kane supposedly didn't want enough was actually a poorer quality ball because of the pressure that the opposition team was putting on the player making the pass. So It looks like Harry Kane doesn't want the ball. Actually, the ball itself is not flighted or not weighted in a particularly perfect way because the opposition has done a good job in stopping that pass being played in a good quality way. And also, there's a tactical game of cat and mouse going on, isn't there? Like, you can't put too many players further forward towards the ball because the opposition then might counter on you, and yeah, it's just it's different tactical nuances.
You got to balance it. For example, England had five defenders on. Had Trippier been Sancho or had Trippier been somebody else, he would have naturally been further up the pitch, and then you would have had a person closer to Kane. But then the other side of that is you'd have had one less person defending. So a lot of it does come down to manager choice and how they believe is the best way to win a football match.
Some of our American followers were asking us to cover the Gold Cup final, but unfortunately, we only cover football on this podcast.
There was also a question on MLS, and I don't watch any MLS.
We also only cover football on this podcast.
But if I was going to watch MLS this season, I would watch Toronto for Jefferson Soltero, who's a fantastic little 5-foot dribbling machine who I've loved for many years, and I think Windy's also very fond of, that if you can remember him.
Yeah, absolutely. He was a very fun player to watch. I'm sure he will.
Still is fun.
He will tear it up.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud, D. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.